The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first global fintech podcast and radio show. This is JP Nichols here live with you this week in Seattle, and I'm joined by Ron Shevlin. Ron, where are you today?
Boston area.
All right, and Sam Maul.
Hey, JP, I'm hiding in my master bedroom closet in Jacksonville.
Well, there's way too many jokes to hit there. So Brett is speaking in Beirut, Lebanon, and I'm happy to say that's no longer a bad late night punchline. He's really excited to be there, and we're excited for some news that we want to share with you even before his return, because we're also joined by Mark Hochstein and Penny Crossman from American Banker. So Mark, where are you today?
Hi, JP. I am in Washington, D.C., today at the Electronic Signatures and Records Association conference. Some good conversations going on down here.
Great. And Penny Crossman, you're in our studio in New York.
Yes, I'm here with Rachel. Never been here before. It's a lot of fun.
Great. Glad to have you both. Well, we're looking forward to having you guys on the show with us, and we're excited to announce that the Breaking Banks podcast is also going to be distributed now from American Banker. So we'll have somebody from the American Banker team on the show and giving us some of the in-depth look at some of the news that they're reporting. So if you've got any questions about a banking news item, tweet it to us at BreakingBanks1, and we'll make sure that Mark or Penny get to that. So speaking of that, at the risk of turning this into a sports show, no bigger story today than the Cubs winning the World Series. I'm not as happy as some people. I grew up in Cleveland. My mom's a huge Indians fan. I know Jim Maroos joins me in being Maroos's Morose, and so am I today. But I'm happy for all of my Cubs fans. Ron, I think you were watching that game from end to end, huh?
Pretty close to it. When the rain delay came, that was a little tough, especially out here on the East Coast. This is why I want to move to the West Coast, so I can actually stay up to watch sporting events.
Yeah, it was a late one. Sam, did you watch a game?
I did, and I teared up, to be honest, because I was a Braves fan all through the 90s, and I've never had that emotion. It's so sad.
No, listen, win or lose, either way, it was exciting to take it 10 innings and win by one run in the 10th and Game 7. It was exciting for both teams. More exciting for the Cubs fans, for sure. And I was busy hanging out with the Seattle Sounders last night. Sam, I know you're a fellow soccer fan, and we're going to hear on one of our interviews coming up today, Naveed Anwar from Capital One. He's a huge Arsenal fan like you, so make sure you stay tuned for that. But let's get on to the other banking news. I saw that Chris Larson is leaving the helm at Ripple. Mark or Penny, do you have any insights on that?
Yeah, I actually spoke with Chris and Brad Garlinghouse the other day, and the way they described it, Chris has been doing this for 20 years, and frankly, I think he didn't say he was burned out, but he did say there's a lot of travel. You know, he's been all in. He has one son that's 6 and one son that's 9, and he's just ready to step back a little bit. He's still going to go in the office every day. He's still the chairman of the he's the executive chairman, so he's going to be in charge of governance. He's going to run the board, and he's going to be contributing a lot to the direction of the company and the strategy. But he also described it as the company has kind of focused more on enterprise software and providing facilitating enterprise payments for companies. So and Brad was a big part of that push. So he kind of described it as Brad is kind of taking this company forward with this intense new focus that he brought.
Great, Ron. Any thoughts or reaction from you?
Yeah, thanks. In the scheme of things, this might not be the biggest impact or biggest news in banking or financial services, but I think we really got to pay homage to Chris, who's one of the great entrepreneurs in fintech. He was either the founder or a co-founder of eLoan, of Prosper, and of Ripple. He also has been a big force in driving a lot of user and consumer privacy efforts. So, I think it's just a good shout out to Chris for all his contributions to fintech and financial services. And you got to bet that he's going to be back in the game at some point.
Yeah, definitely a fintech pioneer. So what else is in the news, Penny?
We have a great reporter named Kristen Broughton who filed a story today about how Wells Fargo CEO Tim Sloan is saying that the company is going to continue doing cross-selling after saying a week or two ago that they were stepping away from cross-selling. And that was sort of a shocker to me. I immediately emailed her and said, what is he thinking? But Mark, you probably have more in-depth background on that than I do.
I think that Wells Fargo is just having a hard time right now. I mean, they're under a spotlight, and they probably haven't completely figured out what their new strategy is going to be. But Tim Sloan said today, there's nothing wrong with cross-selling done right. It's about growing customer relationships, serving our customers, meeting their needs. Of course, the way that they've been cross-selling for all these years, where they were focusing on this metric of the number of products per customer and shooting for 8 products per customer, I think we know now that that's not a very good proxy for deepening the customer relationship.
I was going to say, Mark, I completely agree. I mean, if we were to actually go in and prosecute every bank that cross-sells, we wouldn't have an industry. We wouldn't have any other industry, to be honest. The concept of cross-selling in itself, there's nothing wrong with that. And every single one of us, especially Ron and I, as consultants, this is how long have we been pushing the concept of that, Ron? It's just doing it ethically and doing it right.
Yeah, I agree. But Mark, I'd have to push back on you a little bit. If the number of products per household or customer isn't the right metric or proxy, then what is?
It's not about the
metric. It's the methods that it took to get there that I think we have to criticize Wells Fargo for, but not the metric. I mean, I've worked with them over the years. I would tell you that one of the issues I've had with their metric is how they actually define products. I don't know if they still do it or even more recently, but they would define things like online banking as a product, even though it didn't generate any revenue. But the metric is pretty solid. It's just the methods it took to get there.
Well, but also isn't it looking at the metric without really thinking about whether it's representing what you think it represents?
But that's true of pretty much any metric. Look at all the firms that adopt Net Promoter Score, where they're asking people how likely are you to refer when they don't even track whether or not those people actually refer. So, there's always going to be a disconnect between a particular metric and what's really going on and incentive behaviors. It just really goes down to the point that you can't rely on a single metric for anything. And maybe that's the point to criticize the bank for, is their over-reliance on a single metric.
Yeah. I think for me, one of the interesting stories, and it kind of just popped today, is about Chase Pay and the deal that they've made with Walmart. To put this politely, Walmart yet gives one more middle finger to Apple. with this partnership, and again, good for Chase. I'm impressed with the moves they continue to make.
I think their selling point is they're offering a lower cost solution because they have their own network. They can push the payments through. They don't have to use Visa, MasterCard. So that's got to be appealing to a merchant like Walmart, where I don't know what the volumes are, but they're enormous.
Yeah. That and their name is an apple.
Yeah.
Well, we're definitely at a stage where we're seeing the big banks flex their muscles where they can. And the ex-CEO of Barclays, speaking of big banks, announced formation of a new firm to provide what he's calling API-driven cloud-based core processing services to the banks, and their first client is Virgin Money. I think we're seeing a lot of movement around the core processors as well.
Yeah, there's a handful of startups now in this space, and that just says something right there. Because you know, core processing is just one of those businesses where you know no one ever wants to change. It's so hard to do a core conversion, and the fact that you now have three or four new companies in that area tells you that people smell an opportunity that someone might actually be willing to bite the bullet.
I'll tell you what's most fascinating for the story for me is that we're talking about the ex-Barclays CEO. So it's Anthony Jenkins. So you got somebody who walks into the equivalent of a startup with the bank network in place, the contacts. And when your first client is Virgin Money, well done, right? I mean, right out the gate, good job.
It's a good one to watch because, you know, implementation is key, execution is key, regulatory buy-in to the whole thing is key, which maybe they already have. But here in the U.S., it's been extremely tough for any new core technology provider to actually win clients and make it all the way through the process. There have been some major fails, so it would be very interesting to watch.
Yeah. Well, on the flip side of that, so many of the smaller banks feel, you know, kind of beholden and handcuffed. If their core allows the things that they want to innovate on, great. If they don't, they're kind of stuck. And so I definitely see a new trend coming with the core providers. Well, listen, thanks everyone for joining us for the new segment. I want to move on now so we can get to the rest of our show. Last week, while Brett was at IBM Watson in Las Vegas, I was also in Las Vegas along with Sam and our executive producer, Rachel Morrissey. We were at Money 2020, and we spent some time with Capital One. This is an easy assignment for me to take. I've been a fan of theirs for a while, and we had a chance to sit down and really poke behind the scenes at a few of their executives that are driving their digital efforts. Rachel also got some other interviews while we were at Money 2020. That was quite a gathering place for a lot of fintech people. So you'll hear parts of those on other episodes. But coming up today, you're going to hear the special Invested in Tech series that was made possible thanks to Capital One. So we've got interviews first with Capital One's Global Head of Design, Scott Zimmer, then their Managing VP of Digital, Tom Poole, and finally the Arsenal fan, Sam Naveed Anwar, Managing VP of their Global Platforms. So we'll be right back after this break. This is JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks.
I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks, the first global fintech radio show and podcast.
There's a pretty compelling story in banking, and the things we do for people matter to people on a human level. And in the design community, that's what designers are born to do.
I'm in Las Vegas at Money 2020, the big fintech and payment show. And this is part of our special Invested in Tech podcast series, brought to you by Capital One.
Yeah, hey, I am Scott Zimmer, and I head up design at Capital One.
In this series, we're taking a look behind the scenes at Capital One to see how they're investing in technology, innovation, and design to create better customer experiences.
It's a skill that's missing, at least the obsession around insights, the obsession around creative solutions is missing, you know, in a lot of larger companies, and we really felt it was something that was worthy of investment as we looked ahead.
Scott Zimmer describes himself as a Disney-bred creative and someone who's driven to create. He says that what gets him out of bed every day is leading the effort to build something new and obsessing over what it will take to make it the best. That's a passion and a skill set that's not exactly an oversupply in the banking industry, but Capital One has been on the leading edge of it. So, head of design for Capital One, do you have a lot of peers? Are there a lot of other heads of design at banks and you guys get together at head of design bank conferences?
There are a few, but it's a pretty small group and we know each other in general. It's definitely a growing focus for banks, and it's something that I think we're going to see a lot more of in the future.
Yeah, head of design is definitely a pretty new title in banking. So I asked Scott how long he's been at it and how his role came about.
About 3.5 years ago, we brought all aspects of design at Capital One together under one roof, all aspects of experience design. And that really pulled it from parts of our tech organization, parts of our product organization, and created a single culture where designers could focus on a cohesive ecosystem and have standards and career pathing and things that aren't always common at larger companies for this job family. We were looking to break some ceilings. You know, big banks aren't known for being very adept at welcoming some of the foremost tech leaders or design leaders to the big banking world.
So as we were just joking about it, it's still kind of new. So what really were the drivers to cause Capital One to say, you know, design needs to be an important part of our business?
Yeah, well, it's interesting what's happening right now. If you look at banking, but if you look at many industries, we're moving from an era where customers needed to do it the store's way or the bank's way. You know, bookstores chose where they put up stores and you had to drive to that store and you had to choose from its selection. And Amazon obviously upended all of that. You see the same thing in banking where customers have had to do it the bank's way for years and years, but now there's a greater expectation that the banks would have a lot to gain in building a deeper customer relationship if we understood our customers better and met them where they were. And so when you dig into it, the notion of understanding people and creating solutions that match their needs, that's actually the great definitions of great design.
Design's a lot more than just looking pretty. I've had people also talk about, oh, we want our branch to be more like the Apple store. And when you really dig down a couple of layers, what a lot of them are saying is white walls and, you know, bleach wood furniture. And that's not really what the Apple store experience is all about. So how do you break that down? How do you translate that digitally?
Yeah, well, you're very right. One of the biggest challenges any designer faces is the stereotype that a designer can make something aesthetically gorgeous. And since you used the Apple Store example, I'll grow on that. You know, Steve is famous for saying design is really how something works. And what's interesting about the Apple Store and all of its starkness is they simplified it to make it work better. It's actually what happened. They weren't trying to beautify it. And what else is interesting is if you're noticing every time you go into an Apple Store, it's slightly different because they're iterating constantly. That's an aspect of design that isn't confined to just designers. There's a mindset that we believe our entire company should have, which is an obsession over how do you create something that might work? How do you get it in front of real people? How do you observe how well it's working? And then how do you make adjustments in rapid fashion?
A recurring theme from everyone I talk to at Capital One is a test and learn mentality that's pretty different from the decision-making process at most banks.
Certainly the way it used to be, a big decision that's made on information you have at the moment. It's made around a round table, a big bet of X millions of dollars to launch something. It might take 12 to 18 months. A few years ago when we were preparing for the Apple Pay launch, we dug in very deeply and built prototypes for the wallet app that we ended up launching and got those in front of real users in a qualitative fashion. You've always got the A/B testing, which is something Capital One was built on, and it's something we obsess on. But the qualitative testing is a bit of a new muscle where we've learned through experts that we brought onto our team the do's and don'ts of understanding how people actually use something and how you can learn from the way they use it to make adjustments in it before you end up launching it live. We try to avoid failing at scale is really a great mantra.
Well, you know, Las Vegas is a good place for putting that kind of thing in perspective, right? You think about poker. You don't want to lay all your pot out before the cards have even been dealt. You want to see a card or two, and then the more cards you get, the better information you have. And if you have really, really good cards, then you want to make a bigger bet.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And it's the thing that's transitioned product development dramatically, right? Because you may, in days past, make 2-3 big bets a year. And now any team that's working in this collaborative kind of iterative fashion can be making 60-70 bets at one time, but with minimal investment. And you can progress on the things that seem to have some resonance with your end user.
And you've brought that culture and that philosophy even to the way you're dealing internally, your own internal office space and the way you interact with each other inside the organization. Talk about how design has informed the way you do business internally, not just with customers.
Yeah, well, I'll give two examples. One is we've built a good old user lab that has the one-way mirror, and we didn't know if it was going to be valuable or not, so we built a prototype of it in the middle of one of of our offices, four walls, no windows. And what we learned from that experiment was that bringing real people into the heart of one of the floors where we've got product designers, developers, and product managers working to build the services of tomorrow, bringing real people in to be exposed to how those are working and seeing that everything we build should be anchored on real insights dramatically evolved our culture. Starting with a prototype and building out, we have multiple user labs in multiple locations because it's had such a positive impact on our culture.
Because you're really trying to get to the best answer, not trying to defend the idea that you already had and spend a lot of time developing.
And we're trying to collaboratively get to the best answers. It's much easier to have different mindsets at the table or at the wall contributing if you're not investing deeply in what your message is. So you can have a developer, you know, scratch something out and say, well, what about this? And draw his or her own circle and describe kind of their idea in a very low investment way. And that free thinking actually evolves the conversation dramatically compared to what we're all familiar with which is, you know, a big meeting scheduled at 2:30 where we walk through a PowerPoint presentation that's been worked on for 2 weeks.
Yeah, those endless meetings, slogging through PowerPoint presentations full of bullet points. We could all live with fewer of those.
And sometimes those cases are still warranted, but in those cases, someone has spent a lot of energy to articulate something, and they're going to be a lot more defensive, and they're going to stand by it a lot more than if you're able to freely think through something as a collaborative team.
It also sounds like you believe that design is not something you can outsource. You made a pretty big, splashy acquisition with Adaptive Path, a design agency that most of your brethren in the banking business have not followed. What was the thinking behind that? And talk a little bit about that acquisition.
Yeah, thanks. It's just over 2 years ago, this month, that we acquired Adaptive Path. We just find that the dedication, the ability to deeply understand a customer problem and stick with it, the ability to iterate, as we described earlier, having an in-house team allows for the right kind of collaboration and, you know, quite honestly, allows any company who invests in it to build a proprietary capability there. Right. And that's the kind of thing that can set, you know, one company apart from another. When you really start to have multiple disciplines working together to create great experiences, it's a difference maker. And that's how you get to kind of next generation ideas. Again, as I'll point to, Jack Dorsey, you know, not having anything to do with banking, kind of came in. The Bank Simple founder is the same thing. The boldness comes when you're not restrained. I think a mix is probably the right way to go versus, you know, all non-bankers. But it's been a really large difference maker in our culture.
So talk a little bit about design trends over the last 3 or 4 years. What kinds of things are you seeing that are evolving now in terms of elements that you want to include in customer-facing designs?
We talked a little bit earlier of the transition from, you know, designing an interaction or a user experience to thinking about the broader journey. That's something that's still taking hold, quite honestly, because many banks are really used to the era where you're designing a product and it has certain features or certain pricing. But what you also have to consider is that product has touch points way beyond the transaction. Through the fact that they have that product, that's all part of their journey. And what's critical to understand is any point in that journey can fall down, but all of that journey can be choreographed and thoughtfully planned for, and even prioritized. That's where service design comes in.
Good design can make better customer experiences, and it can encourage better collaboration on internal teams. But good designers have to think beyond apps and physical spaces. Earlier this year, Capital One launched the first banking skill for the Amazon Echo voice interface.
Let's see, it was March, South by Southwest, we announced our Alexa skill for the first time, and you could actually ask Alexa some information about your bank account. We have a team that focuses on conversation design, that is a combination of, you know, UX design and journalism, and really obsessing around the humanity that has to come through in an interaction and what the word choices are. And last week, we built on that Alexa skill, and we announced something new that we're especially excited about. And this is where I think design is probably going, is unleashing new capabilities. So the skill we announced last week is a new capability called How Much Did I Spend? And it's the first time we've ever been able to build in a natural language query as though you're talking to your money. So by using human-centered design to replicate what we're able to experience in the real world, and designing an interaction that allows you to ask the computer, which is very good at adding things up and getting a real answer, now you're able to take the interaction a lot of steps farther than it's ever been, from kind of a utility, I'll check in, to a decision-making input.
I asked Scott if his team was working with Apple's new Taptic engine to incorporate more nuanced touch feedback and tactile sensations for users.
You know, I think I have to boldly say absolutely. What's really interesting is it's a new definition of our interaction, you know, with the humans we serve, and anything that we can incorporate to improve that experience is on the table. And certainly it's all about the context. What's the right context for the right situation? And so where technology is taking us, and we're able to use taptic feedback and there doesn't even need to be a sound. It gets pretty exciting, quite honestly. And we've got a lot of smaller teams trying a lot of those more aggressive types of innovations, and it's a blast.
So you said that banking is a compelling story and a compelling story for design. What is that compelling story to you?
There's tons of parallels between banking and real physical health. There's choices we wish we were making that we're not making. I think what the future holds for us ahead is building a stronger relationship with our money, so that it's not something that we shy away from and feel is out of control, but rather a chance for us to set goals and achieve them. And the ability to leverage software's capability to do that is this new era that's upon us of creating new products and services. And that's going to be a combination of developers, designers, product managers, no matter which way you cut it. So I think design plays a huge role, and there's a bright future ahead.
That was my interview with Scott Zimmer, Global Head of Design at Capital One. Stay tuned to this Invested in Tech podcast series for more on how technology, innovation, and design can create a better banking experience, brought to you by Capital One. Until next time, this is JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
Hey guys, it's Brett King from Breaking Banks. If you've ever listened to my podcast and enjoyed it, you'll know I focus a lot on the future. When you look at artificial intelligence, robotics, self-driving cars, smart infrastructure, smart cities, health tech, gene editing, computers everywhere that are smart, this is going to have major impact in the way we live our life and the way society interacts. That's the subject of my new book, Augmented, Life in the Smart Lane, which comes out in the first week of May. Ramez Nam, the Philip K. Dick award-winning author of Nexus, said, "You need to read this awesome roadmap of the future that Brett King has created." Please go and check out Augmented, Life in the Smart Lane, available on Amazon for order today.
We're always talking business.
Talk to an expert.
Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
There are 1,000 ways to mess up a feature, and really only one or two to get it exactly right.
This is JP Nichols, and this is a special Breaking Banks episode, part of our Invested in Tech series, brought to you by Capital One. We sit down with Tom Poole.
I'm Tom Poole with Capital One. I lead our digital payments function.
Tom is one of the people working to make Capital One a bank of the future, dressed more like a banker than the programmer he was at the beginning of his career. He's been in hot demand, shuttling between business meetings, interviews, and a panel appearance. His passion for the possibilities of the future and thinking about how banks should make customers' lives better is obvious. One of the reasons we were excited to take a look behind the scenes at Capital One is their reputation for working to be in the forefront of innovation. The bank has the DNA of a technology company and knows that serving customers is a very different thing from years past. Tom was at Money 2020.
Money 2020 is the epicenter of all things payments in the industry.
Tom was on a panel here called
the role of mobile wallets in streamlining online and mobile app payments.
Sure. So there's a lot of questions right now about what is a mobile wallet and what does it do for consumers? And how do they all fit together? Because there are lots of mobile wallets coming from lots of companies. And so there are questions about what does a Capital One mobile wallet do, or what do bank mobile wallets more generally do? And that was contrasted a lot with the other kinds of wallets that are out there. You see wallets from tech giants that are really about paying at the point of sale, using a device for payments, and bringing some of the technology giant specialties into that experience. And then you had merchant wallets still as a third category, which did something different. They tended to be reflections of really great loyalty programs merchants offer. We can use all of them and like all of them, and they really don't compete with one another. And candidly, we're pretty happy if you use any of those with a Capital One payments product inside of it.
But yet you think you have a certain advantage as a bank, and you want to make sure your mobile wallet plays up to those advantages.
We do. And again, we think it comes back to that information and control. The bank authorizes the transaction. We are the first to know whether a transaction's been approved, what it was for, who it was with, and to deliver that information to the consumer. That's an advantage we have. Building from it, we can begin to find patterns, find insights, just figure out that you just charged something twice in a row. Does this mean it was a double charge? Figure out that a bill jumped 50% from the month before, or that a trial period ran out and you're now actually being billed for a service. Do you want to do that? These are the kinds of things consumers tell us that matter. They want to understand these better. They're not always on top of their spending as much as they'd like to be. And in this case, Capital One's in a perfect position to actually point that out to consumers and make it really easy for them to change their mind if they're buying something they don't want.
Since banks are the first to know about a transaction, they get a lot of pressure to make frictionless payments. But Tom thinks there's a healthy use for friction.
That's right. There was a lot of talk about frictionless payments, and it's really a hot term in the industry right now because everybody wants to carve out steps that feel unnecessary or not value-adding to the payment. There are times when friction is a good thing. Sometimes I need to be told that I'm about to pay for something that would otherwise be completely off my radar screen. Sometimes I need to be told that if I don't return something in the next 2 weeks that I just bought, I'm going to be stuck with a shirt that doesn't fit, doesn't look good, and it's going to be hanging in my closet as a memorial to a bad spending decision I made. And banks can play a role by providing services to make these things really easy in as many cases as we can. And that's really a unique thing we believe we can deliver for customers.
Well, embedded in the Capital One culture is a test and learn philosophy, and you've learned a few things from your customers by having this mobile wallet in the market, and one of the things you learned about was the kinds of notifications they like to receive and versus the ones that maybe they don't want.
Yeah, so what we found is customers like anything that gives them knowledge of where their money's going. It turns out in today's world, we have these wonderful spending tools that allow us to spend money, and oftentimes we're going to merchants and we're giving them our credentials for a payment, but then the credential rests there. And so in some cases we can be billed again, and sometimes we've agreed to these things, and it's perfectly legitimate. It's not a fraudulent transaction anyway, but we forget about it. It's tough for anybody to stay on top of. And so what we found is notifications that really give customers insights into these kinds of things are hugely valued. And so any step we can take to create that transparency of where's my money going, just because it's precious and I don't want to misspend it. And again, that's not necessarily fraud. It could just be stuff I didn't need, didn't want. And I can tell you, no matter what your means are in life, nothing pains you more, whether it's $5 or $50, than spending money on that gym membership where you haven't been in 3 months.
Isn't that the truth?
It appalls anybody of any means to have done that. I don't care where you sit in life. It appalls anybody paying $5 for a subscription to a website they're no longer using and don't have need for. And when we see it, oftentimes, it's so hard to do something about it. We just let it continue, and it becomes this open wound for us. And so we're about making sure you get every value from every dime you're spending with us.
Capital One added payment functionality to their Android version of their wallet, and they're also working with Apple Pay.
And the way the Apple wallet works in iOS, you don't have that flexibility to add your own payment capability. So what kind of changes are you making in the Apple environment?
So for Apple, we asked ourselves, well, how can we be the best possible experience with Apple Pay for our customers? And so we looked at ways to integrate, to complement, to really answer the question of, yes, I have Apple Pay and it would be the same no matter which bank I use, but why, you know, how could we make it better for Capital One customers? And so we've looked at ways to add new data, new types of alerts, better integration with Apple Pay so you can go into the Capital One wallet. And if you've provisioned Apple Pay, you'll see an Apple button right on the corner of the card that will open directly to Apple Pay to your Capital One card ready for purchasing in that moment. And it's worked rather well. We continue to look for ways to make it easier to use. Again, because so much of the battle for customers' attention will be not only that you support these platforms, but that you find ways to make your experience on these platforms, whether it's Apple, Google, whomever, richer and better.
Well, that fits into a general theme you've talked about a lot, is customer experience. So payments, thinking about, you know, these little microsecond transactions of maybe just a few dollars, yet you spend a lot of time, you and your team, thinking pretty deeply about the customer experience. Talk a little bit more about your philosophy around customer experience and payments.
Well, you know, the great thing about the payments customer experience is none of it's actually about the payment, right? It's all about the information and the experience that surrounds that payment. And there's not a lot of friction in that process once you get to that point. What's missing, though, is the information after the transaction. All of these little pieces of the transaction, whether it's receipts, reminders, notes about the transaction, just remembering that I don't need to buy this again, communicating with others that I might have bought things. This is tends to be where the friction is, and I think there are just so many more. It's too many to list on both before and after. So we obsess about what is that experience that really surrounds the transaction. That's where we put a ton of our energy to say, what information do you need to make smarter, better decisions? What resources can we bring from anywhere we can find them on your behalf to help you save money or save time? That's really where the gist of the payments evolution has really happened so far.
So you're really thinking holistically across the entire customer experience, not just the moment of payment or the point of sale. We talked yesterday to Scott Zimmer, Global Head of Design for Capital One, and he talked a lot about experience design. And that sounds like that's a process you're incorporating in your line of business as well.
No question. And it's an art, because so many of the quote unquote, and I have to say this with a grain of salt, great ideas that we have turn out to have no resonance at all with consumers. And so we spend a ton of energy circulating these ideas with consumers. We put user labs right in our building so we can bring consumers in and provide input to a process. We've had to refine our technique where we no longer formally draft beautiful designs to share with customers. We hand draw things, because if they make them too nice, people don't want to insult your feelings. Design asks a consumer what they think it's supposed to do, not tell them what we think it's supposed to do. And then if we don't get feedback that makes sense, we'll go back and iterate it and change it again. And we do all of that, all with the preparation to launch, knowing full well that even with that amount of preparation, it still might be the wrong experience. And then pay very careful attention in market, taking steps like calling consumers as soon as they use the feature to ask them in 2 minutes, what do they think? It turns out if you ask them for 45 minutes, they'll come up with a world of things that no one had ever really thinks about in nature. And so you have to be very careful to just try to skim the exact amount of time your consumers really want to give to this. And make sure what we're building really resonates with people. And so, yes, as Scott would tell you, an enormous amount of work goes into that. And even so, it is art, 90% art, 10% science, even when you're said and done with all of that.
While Tom and his team can work through an issue very thoroughly from end to end, sometimes product teams can get a little too close to things.
You know, we had this great button in our wallet app when we started. And it was the button I mentioned earlier. It was basically a button that would tell you if a card was provisioned to Apple Pay. You could tap it and it would take you over to Apple Pay. And when we first had the button, tap to pay was on the button. And so we started calling consumers to say, what do you think about the app? And they said, well, everything's great except this button's broken. We said, what do you mean it's broken? They said, well, when I press it, instead of allowing me to pay my bill, it takes me over to Apple Pay. And so we realized this was this feature that ultimately people do end up liking, and it gets a lot of great feedback in the market. But because we called it tap to pay, they were looking for full bill pay functionality, which was a lesson to us, because we didn't conceive of putting bill pay function in the wallet. We have it in our Capital One mobile app, our servicing app. And so first steps we took was to change it to actually say exactly what we meant. So we put an Apple logo on it and said Apple Pay. No more feedback. People knew exactly what it did. They were still asking for the ability to pay the bill. So now we put a link into the main app that allows you to go right over to the main app. We insisted on having the highest standard of experience. So there was no logging into the main app. If you have it, it's a seamless experience. It almost feels like you haven't left the app, because it takes you right over from one app to the other. So it's might as well be one big app from the consumer's perspective, immediately to the bill pay page, and makes it incredibly easy to pay the bill. Two sources of customer frustration gone, but it took a lot of fine tuning to realize exactly that consumers' expectations about what the app would do and what we as designers had thought it should do, totally different. And ultimately, we lose that battle every time, and happily so.
At the end of the day, it's all about labeling the right button with the right words.
Yeah, there are 1,000 ways to mess up a feature, and really only one or two to get it exactly right. And so when you launch a feature, you never know if it's a great feature where the design was just off by a few millimeters or whatever metaphorical distance you want to describe. It's incredibly tough, but incredibly fun and challenging at the same time.
While we're seeing high adoption of mobile payments, Capital One is working to make sure they meet customers where they are, wherever that may be.
Okay, everybody looks at Uber as the quintessential payments experience and where things could evolve. I think Uber is a fantastic experience. I use it pretty reliably myself, or Lyft, one of the two services. I think what we found, however, is that in some cases consumers want that, and in taxis it may have made perfect sense where that last payment exercise held up your getting to your destination, oftentimes took place at odd places in the city streets and so forth, and so it was a perfect place to background payments. In other places, we find consumers actually want to see parts of the payments process, and if we offered incredibly streamlined and visible payments experiences, there'd be discomfort. You can get too far ahead of your consumers. That's not to say they won't go there someday, but sometimes they want security and verification. Hey, I want to know, you know, I'm actually paying. When we've done tests, at least conceptually, of whether you could lump gift cards and loyalty programs and have all of it happen in one magic tap, we tend to find feedback that they want to back out and say, wait a minute, I need to see. I don't trust that that gift card was applied. I'm afraid I'm overpaying, or I didn't, that coupon I had, was that actually applied? And so we find that you have to do what is often called in the industry the Maya principle of product design, which is most advanced yet acceptable, that you can't outpace your consumers or be too far ahead of them. You need to earn their trust and get them to that place. They'll get there eventually if you take the right steps, but they don't always want to leap there necessarily. And so we're always looking for that balance in what we do. At the moment, we don't think every payment will background quite like Uber.
So some progress in the last year. What should we expect to see over the coming year?
We're super excited about what we can do with the data we have. We've invested an enormous amount to make transaction data easy to work with, to build the platforms internally that will allow us to begin to generate insights at a much more rapid pace, and then to translate those into really winning value propositions with consumers. And again, we just think there's so much meat on the bone, so many things we as consumers know we should care about, know we should do. They're just too hard to do today. They're incredibly manual. The burden is left to us. We think we can automate an enormous amount of that, so we're incredibly excited. We think there'll be a proliferation of payment choices that will be safe, secure, give consumers lots of flexibility. There are a few key areas where we really do want to continue to take out friction. We've got some exciting solutions lined up for how we can do that. So things are only getting started. I think we're in mile one of the marathon.
Thanks to Tom Poole and to Capital One for making the Invested in Tech series possible. If you haven't heard my interview with Scott Zimmer, Capital One's Global Head of Design, go back and give that one a listen too. We'll continue the series next week. Thanks for listening. This is JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks.
Look, there's a platform transformation that is taking place in the industry, and we're in the midst of it.
I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks. This is part three of our special Invested in Tech series, brought to you by Capital One. Today, we're talking with Naveed Anwar.
I run the platform group at Capital One. I'm the managing vice president.
About open banking platforms and working with outside developers. What Ron Shevlin likes to call the platformification of banking. Naveed calls himself a bald geek. His words, but it does seem like an apt description. He was very busy at Money 2020, shuttling between meetings about Capital One's Dev Exchange and their new open APIs.
Our goal over here is to be part of the conversation, and that's why I'm at Money 2020. If you really want to be in the fintech space, this is the mecca of all the conferences that you have to be present at.
He recently tweeted out a picture of his massive collection of soccer jerseys.
As of right now, and I did an inventory last week where I was cleaning my closet, I own 42 jerseys. I've been a fan of Arsenal, I would say, since 1979, when my dad went to England for the very first time, and he asked me, what can I bring you back? I said, bring me a red jersey. He happened to bring me an Arsenal jersey, and I became a fan of Arsenal in 79, only being 6 years old.
And his favorite player?
These days, obviously, it's Ozil, because he's a master to watch.
You can see the same devotion in Naveed's work that he displays as a soccer fan. He appreciates mastery. He strives for it himself, and he's quick to recognize it in others. That mindset has been particularly valuable as he heads up the efforts to open up Capital One's platforms and invite outside developers to create new, better and refined experiences for their customers.
First and foremost thing is that, look, there's a platform transformation that is taking place in the industry, and we're in the midst of it. Our consumers want their information available to them at any time, anywhere, it is our job to make that convenience and that experience available to our consumers. I mean, a platform transformation is not an easy thing to do in an industry such as banks. It is a slow and steady process, but Capital One is a leader in this space. We've been transforming the way that we actually build products within our own walls, and that's where we feel like you have to start the transformation internally.
With that in mind, Naveed and his team launched DevExchange to developers. That means that every new feature and product being developed isn't necessarily created by somebody within the bank.
Is an opportunity for startups, for innovators, to be able to co-create experiences. Our first three APIs that we released were SwiftID, our Rewards API, and Credit Offers. And so far, it's been actually a good learning process since March.
So let's pull the Zoom lens back a little bit and talk about just the broader vision of why open banking and why does that matter and how is that really different strategically than running a closed infrastructure?
If we need to innovate and we need to be able to be relevant, innovation needs to take place with a platform mindset. We have started to release our APIs with a mindset that we cannot create all the experiences for our consumers, and we want to tap into the developer community, but in a manner in which we can actually co-create this experience together.
APIs, application programming interfaces. A set of well-defined standards that allow different kinds of software applications to talk to one another and build on each other. Think about how Google Maps pops up in other programs, like Yelp, for instance. I asked Naveed to talk about the APIs that Capital One have made available and explain a little bit about what they do.
Well, DevExchange, as we launched in South by Southwest, is in its beta. Our goal was to learn and go slow by working with the developer community, because there are multiple personas out in this community, and we wanted to make sure that we were addressing the needs of all. We launched with creditcards.com, which is the ability for people to qualify for credit cards on an affiliate site. It has really shown results both for us as well as the partner. SwiftID is the ability of actually doing two-factor authentication within an application. So that, let's say you wanted to go and get some work done at a garage, but you wanted to watch a movie as well. So you don't want to be actually getting that phone call all the time. So what if you were given a notification in which you could actually swipe, do kind of biometric authentication, but give that ability of authorizing the work that needed to be done on your behalf, and a developer can actually create that experience. And last but not least is our Rewards API, which we launched at South by Southwest with Award Wallet as our launch partner. And since then, we've seen this materialize in our relationship with Uber, where we actually sat down with them and actually built the experience around rewards, where you can actually get your 10th ride free on Uber using a Quicksilver or Quicksilver One card. It is an opportunity for us to kind of also test and learn with these strategic partners. So the fact that we can actually sit down and create that experience from a design thinking approach and really do the study with the consumers allows us to create those experiences.
So you have a very strong test and learn data-driven environment. How does that work bringing outside developers into that, and how do you manage that?
Everything around a developer program, and particularly DevExchange, as I said, is about co-creation, right? If you don't listen to your community, you will be irrelevant. So we decided to make sure that we are tapping into the developers as part of our beta program early and enough, right? So far, they've given us great feedback on our testing environment, in which, believe it or not, it takes less than 120 seconds or so for you to actually sign up and become a community member with us and make your first call in our sandbox environment. The second one is really sitting down with them and actually having a conversation of what kind of products can we open up. We have taken a maniacal approach in making sure that our documentation is done in a manner which is world-class. And I feel very proud in the work that our team has done in making that experience very easy for developers. And so far, the feedback that we've received is that our documentation, our way of actually onboarding a developer is second to none in the place, and we compete directly with the leading technology companies. So it's really around three things. It's about listening to your community and gathering their feedback, making sure that you do it in a self-service manner, and number three, reacting to the ever-changing industry that we are in and being relevant.
I asked Naveed what he's learned so far from the beta of DevExchange.
The pieces of feedback in the beta have been really around ease of use of our APIs, around reference applications that we have actually created and made available to them. Also around how we can actually make more testing data available for them in the sandbox environment. So every single time a developer wants to test their application, they're looking for false use cases as well as positive use cases. So they're looking for us to expand that data that we make available in the testing environment. So those are some of the few that come to mind that our developers have given feedback us on.
I was curious about how Naveed and his team decided on what APIs they were going to make available to the developer community.
We wanted to make sure that as we were choosing the APIs, we were also trying to show the breadth of verticals that we could actually go after. So identity and trust is a huge factor for developers when they're actually thinking and building and associating themselves with a brand. So we wanted to show that, hey, that's a place that we secure our consumers through SwiftID for our consumer applications. So we wanted to make the same API available for the developer community. Loyalty to a brand and loyalty to a program also is very key. And then also showing them a way in which they can actually have channels of acquisition. So those are the three areas that we wanted to initially target. But now, as I mentioned, in the fall timeframe, we will be expanding those to multiple areas.
So talk about how it works when developers using your APIs, they've created something. How do you decide whether that's something then you want exposed directly to Capital One customers?
The process is pretty simple. A developer comes to DevExchange, signs up, and gets a name within our namespace. And then very quickly, they can choose within the three APIs that we've made available and create an application within our sandbox environment. And as long as they're adhering to the terms and conditions that have been listed out, their application gets production access and they can take their application production.
So do you help distribute that? Is there an actual app store for Capital One customers?
These are things that we're looking into. In the coming time frame, you'll hear a little bit more announcements as we actually go into general availability of our platform. Those are absolutely ways in which we want to promote the developers who are early on adopters of our technology. You can actually have conversations with our partners, creditcards.com or Wad Wallet. They were present with us at March at South by Southwest, and when they were standing with us on stage when those announcements were made. And if you create something which is viable for our consumers, we will do whatever we can to promote them in the community. Building and sustaining platform mindset, if you're thinking about this, requires a lot of patience. And it's not a transformation that takes place overnight. So if you as a developer who are about to invest in a fintech innovation, keep Capital One in mind. Unlike other developer programs that you might have actually participated in, this is one in which we want to create equal value for both. It's about co-exchange of ideas and co-value that we can create. That's what DevExchange is all about.
Building relationships with developers is a lot different than building relationships with customers.
A consumer actually builds a relationship with a bank or with a financial institution is to share a lot of information about themselves before they can actually start getting the product offerings which are going to meet their needs. The difference with the developer is making this experience least frictionless possible for them so that within minutes they can actually make their first call in a sandbox environment and launch that experience. So gathering the least amount of data from a developer is the way that you actually get that developer integrated into a community and you start meeting their needs.
So where do we go from here and what are the next couple of APIs we might expect to see coming out?
Without getting into much details, because we haven't actually announced it, think about areas which are very hot to the consumers as well as developers. It's more identity services, subscription-based services, transactions, and even the ability of opening an account. I think one message which I will tell everyone is that, look, we don't have all the answers, so we're really looking at feedback from the community. So if you have ideas in which you think Capital One can actually help your business, we're open to those and would love to hear back from you.
Capital One has been a pretty active acquirer. Does DevExchange play into that, or is that really run completely separate from any corporate acquisition or minority investments that you might make?
Look, if you build a platform, you build a platform with a mindset that is actually going to help your lines of businesses to grow. Credit Offers, as our first API, actually deepens our relationships with the acquisition of new consumers with our affiliate program. So that is what we are expanding to our remaining affiliates. So absolutely, that is a mindset that we have in our walls to make sure that we're building value proposition, not just for our partners, but for our line of business as well. I can only talk about from a Capital One perspective, like our goal is to insource and build and take advantage of all the technologies that are available to us. That has been one of the goals for Capital One for the last few years, where we started a technology transformation, which is like, how do we actually get away from our SOAP services into a more RESTful interface and create services which is not going to require us to reinvent the wheel all the time. We at Capital One think of us as a technology company, which actually happens to be a bank. Now, other banks, they talk about working with system integrators and vendors and call themselves technology companies. But I think we leave this in the hands of consumers who actually rate our application 5-star on the Apple Store. And I think volumes speak for the feedback that we get from our consumers.
That was Naveed Anwar, head of Dev Exchange for Capital One. Thanks again to Naveed and to Capital One for making this Invested in Tech podcast series possible. If you like this, be sure to listen to my other interviews with Scott Zimmer, Capital One's Global Head of Design, and Tom Poole, their Managing VP of Digital. This is JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern time, for more of the latest in fintech news.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.